Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. In this episode, I talk to Nick Thomas, co-founder and instructor at the Academy of Historical Fencing in the UK, about his HEMA origins and his collection of antique swords. The episode was recorded on Instagram Live, 13 July 2021.
Hi.
Hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Lovely to have you on.
Thanks.
So, yeah, thanks for coming. I love the background.
Thank you.
That's a big poster, or is that a mural?
Oh, it's actually vinyl, but I'm going to redo it. I'm going to redo the Roathart on there as soon as I can actually get the time.
Looks good. So, thank you for coming on the show. Let's start off with the very most basic question of all. How did you get into HEMA?
So, we're a group of us who are reenactors, my brother Michael and I. And through the reenactments, we started looking to do kind of more competitive fighting on the side, partly to improve our reenactment fighting and partly for just fun. And we did that for quite a few years. There were no manuals or anything like that. That was kind of like 96 onwards. And and eventually the group that we were in collapsed, but soon after we reformed as a, well, we didn't really know what it was at the time. We called ourselves a sword club. And we just did basically HEMA without manuals and without fencing masks in the early days as well. So things have come on a long way. And then, yeah, we found manuals and fencing masks and other things. And so that's how it came along.
So it all kind of coagulated together and joined the HEMA movement. And I guess you kind of made contacts with, I mean, this is a long time ago. We're talking a long time ago. What, 96 you started?
Yeah.
So you were there in the days of UK, the latest wave of HEMA.
I guess we made contact with other groups maybe in the mid-2000s or something like that, particularly when I joined the Scholar Forum. That was kind of, you know, that was one of the big, you know, forums back then. And that's how I learned about Fight Camp and turned up there for the first time, which I think was about 2007, I think, something like that. So, yeah.
So you'd spent a lot of time doing the practical bit of HEMA before you got into the texts and so forth.
Exactly. So we were a mix of martial artists. So I'd done a lot of taekwondo. We did a lot of reenactment fighting. Two of the guys were sport fencers, various other sort of kendo experience and stuff like that. And we kind of, you know, bodged it all together into a free fighting style. And then when we found, we sort of reworked it back and started, you know, working from the texts.
It's really interesting to hear like the origins of long established groups like the AHF and things like this, because one of the most common things that folks say to me on places like TikTok and Instagram is, I can't find a club anywhere near me, what do I do? And in pre-COVID times, everyone would have sort of said to them, just find a buddy and just, you know, practice in your garden or practice in a park or something, just work it out. And that's exactly how many clubs started out. From those very sort of humble origins, those sort of like literally just feeling your way.
I think, you know, some people have it a bit harder than we did, because we had that reenactment basis and because we had a, you know, mix of other sort of martial arts and sport fencing experience. It gave us a bit of an easier way, you know, when it's sort of two or three people trying to start from scratch, I think you're going to have it a bit harder. We kind of stumbled our way through things. Fans, you know, tell half a manuscript like everybody does early on, and you know that's you know, entry, and John Clements' medieval swordsmanship book, which seems like it's quite an amazing thing to look at when you don't have any other manuals.
Yeah, baby's first HEMA manual, little Taubhofer pictures.
Yeah.
And so you, it was Tau. I guess you were, when you were starting out, you were looking at the medieval period, were you?
So my real entry into manuals was rapier, and that was in the early 2000s. And I eventually went to teach Capoferro, and I did that for, well, I still do that now, but that was my big thing for many years. And so, yeah, now I do obviously a lot of British military swordsmanship type stuff. But back then, for quite a few years, rapier was my main thing. And I like to do some stuff with my swords and bits. But yeah, mostly just rapier and companion weapons was my big style.
So when you started to take it seriously and look at the texts and develop your HEMA kind of career, it was rapier was the track.
Yeah,
you
that
took.
Was for me. Mike did basically the kind of German longsword stuff, working through various the early masters until he eventually came to Meyer. I dabbled in different things, but realistically, I was dedicated entirely to just Capoferro's rapier. I went through a lot of rapier manuals and looked for the one that kind of gelled best with basically what I liked, and I just stuck to that and then began teaching it.
So you were lucky to also have your brother as your club founder, fellow organizer, because you know, speaking from experience, running a HEMA club can be quite a burden, quite an enormous task to take on for just one person. But at what point did you kind of between yourselves decide, right, we are going to be a martial arts club and we're going to teach this stuff to people as a martial art?
The big turning point was in 2006, when it was just, you know, it was just a few of us. I think it was five or six of us that had started it, which were just basically a group of friends, you know, all from the kind of that reenactment scene and stuff. And it was the realization that if we didn't start teaching people, we wouldn't have more opponents to fight. So that's why we decided to just open the doors and say, okay, we're going to, you know, take a curriculum on board and start teaching new people, because, you know, we want more people to fight.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I'm quite an evangelist for HEMA in general, like on every platform. I'm always just trying to get people to take it up. Yeah. And I think that, like, I'm like, just take it up, just do it. It's great. It's amazing. But the main reason that all of us want other people to do it is so we can fight them.
Absolutely. You know, more people all the time, everywhere
possible. Want people to fight.
Exactly. That's always been our main ambition.
And so you got into reenactment, and then you went down the path towards what became the modern UK HEMA movement. You started the AHF with Mike. You took the rapier route. He took the longsword route. How did you come to fall into British military sabre? How did that happen?
Because of the sort of reenactment, we'd always done kind of hangers and broadswords and that kind of thing, but again, without any man. And then we had kind of the Hanway Hutton sabres, and we dabbled with those. Again, not really with any sources, a little bit of Hutton, but not much. The big turning point was in Vienna in the Dren event, when, so I was teaching rapier at that event. I think this was maybe 2008, I think. And an instructor there, an Austrian instructor called Peter Zillinger, was running a sabre class. And he ran either a 2 or 3 hour workshop, and it was kind of sabre through the ages. And he kind of started with the earliest manuals on sabre in the kind of in the 18th century, and transitioned through up to the kind of, like, you know, Italian dueling sabre stuff of the late 19th and early 20th century, and kind of showed a whole range of how it kind of evolved from kind of that beginning to end. And that kind of ignited my passion for it. And I bought a sabre off him, which was, you know, kind of twice the weight of the kind of the old Hanway Hutton things that we were using. And went from there, and that's when we really started looking for manuals that we could work from. And when he'd started with some of the earlier texts, he'd worked from Angelo and Roeth and stuff like that, which showed the kind of very, what we'd call the kind of slip style of sabre fencing. And and it was kind of an obvious in for us, because, you know, it was a British source. Not that we'd actually done anything British up until that point, because we were doing entirely Italian and German. And it was, so, well, this is going to be easy for us, because it's in our own language. In a period, because, you know, it's a period that we love anyway, having grown up reading and watching the Sharp films all the time.
Oh, yes.
So it was kind of a logical transition, really, because Peter's class was excellent. And we ended up fighting him and his students sort of for that year and the year after that. And just kind of, that was a sword. It kind of ignited a passion, really.
So when you say slip fencing, is that slipping the leg?
Exactly. So, yeah. So as time went on, the front leg tended to just stay in place unless it needed to. There was that sort of period of time where the slip became the kind of normal procedure for most parries in the British sort of swordsmanship style. And so, yeah, we do kind of call it the sort of slip-based fencing system, which, I mean, doesn't sound the best. Slipping doesn't sound like the best thing to do when you're fencing, but
it works.
Yeah.
So we are here really to talk about swords. We just heard you've got some swords with you. But before we sort of delve into your collection of toys, tell us, like, you said that it was when you were at Drain Event that you were made aware of the whole British military sabre corpus. So was it around that time when you started collecting antique weapons?
Yeah, it was. My first sword I just picked up on eBay. Back then you could buy swords on eBay, and I just found anything that was on eBay and bought it. And my first sword was a French spadroon, effectively, which is an unusual sword in itself. It's from about 1820. It's not a particularly nice example, but it was a start. And then getting into the British military swordsmanship, I wanted, you know, everybody that does, you know, that era of British swordsmanship wants a light cavalry sabre. It's the iconic thing. And Matt Easton had one for sale. This was before he was a dealer. So this was about 2008 or maybe 2009, one of those. And he had a light cavalry sabre for sale. And I just met up with him at an antiques fair and grabbed it off him.
It's really funny because one of my previous interviews was with Thierry, and the first thing he sold as an antiques dealer was to Matt Easton on Matt Easton's birthday.
Brilliant.
And it all leads back to Matt Easton. Do you think as a long standing HEMA school and as a very experienced HEMA instructor, do you think there is a lot of value in for a student of historical martial arts in handling antique swords?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the training swords that we have try and emulate the originals as best as they possibly can, but they're always limited by often cost and things like that, and manufacturing processes. And also there's just a deep connection to the original objects. I don't mean on a kind of spiritual level, but just in terms of how exceptional they can handle. At times, sometimes some antiques handle like absolute dogs. So it's quite interesting to see the whole spectrum. You know, we do a lot with spadroons, for example, and you can get spadroons which are the worst sword that you've ever possibly seen. And I have one like that, which is terrible. And it's good that people can see the really nice examples. And I don't mean pretty, but I mean, you know, good fighting swords. Although pretty swords are good as well. That is appreciated. But just to actually handle the real thing and handle what it's actually like. And also to then confirm that their training swords are, you know, relatively good depictions of the things that we're using. Because sometimes people look at the training swords and just think they're way too light. They think, oh, the real thing could never have been this light. And I mean, they weren't always. Again, there's this whole broad spectrum when you look at antique swords. But yeah, I think it's hugely valuable to get a feel for what the real thing's like. I think it puts it in perspective. And I do, where possible, try and bring antiques in for people to handle so they can into the clubs. Again, not at the moment because of COVID, unfortunately, but normally. And it just gives a really good feel for what they're actually like. You do see people's eyes light up on handling them. And it's a big difference between seeing them in a museum, which they're always behind glass anyway. But there's a massive difference between seeing them in a museum and actually getting them in the hand and swinging them. And the moment people swing a good sabre around, they do really light up.
I think that's one of my favourite moments is seeing the light come on in someone's eyes when they hold, not even necessarily a HEMA person, but like anyone who when they pick a sword up for the first time, there's like a something flickers on, there's some kind of connections made there when they pick a sword up for the first time. And you just reminded me of like a few times when, obviously in pre-COVID times, when I've been to the Wallace Museum and we've done a handling session there's nothing like it. There's nothing like handling an original antique sword.
Absolutely not. We did a handling session at, it reminds me, you asked about buying swords and things. That first year that I bought that light cab was also the year that we handled them at the Royal Armoury. So we did a handling session that either 2008 or 2009, and they had a light cab there. And that might have actually been what pushed me to go and find one, an original. So, and the Wallace collection is, you know, one of the best collections in the world, particularly for the Renaissance period stuff. It's just epic.
And then of course, if you're holding them, you get to see them up close as well. Like you say, when it's behind glass, it's one thing, but actually, you know, being able to hold the thing in your hand and look at it from every angle is magical.
Definitely. It's weird in cabinets. People can't really get much of a feel for the scale and you know, and the feel for what anything would be like.
And there are so many swords made, and there are so many swords in museums. We only see a tiny, like the very, very tip of the iceberg of what is actually there.
Absolutely. Every museum has got massive stores that they can't put on display.
They just can't possibly. It's like in the Royal Armouries, they've got that tower, haven't they? It's like a kaleidoscope.
Yes,
of swords and arms and armor, and just they've got it on. It's very clever. They've got it like a sort of hexagonal tower with weapons on every wall, and then there's like an inner walls, and then there's a mirror at the bottom.
Yeah,
like in a kaleidoscope, so you can see everything just by looking into this mirror and just see everything that's on display.
It's really showing off. I mean, particularly some of the things they're hanging are actually individually of really rare. So the fact they then just have, you know, 100 of them that they can make a wheel out of is quite cheeky, but yeah.
It's quite a flex.
Yeah, it is.
And it's like, you know, someone said you should put, in case of zombie outbreak, break glass.
That's true.
I remember you did a book about that one time, you and Mike. You did a zombie survival handbook, I think.
We did. That's kind of how we got started as writers, is the first thing we did was a zombie survival guide. And it's kind of very gimmicky and very silly, and then we did zombie fiction, and then it kind of exploded from there.
That was mostly with guns, though, wasn't it? You didn't use swords in that one, I don't recall.
Well, everything that we write, we try and throw some kind of swords or sword-like object in every single time. You know, like we did a zombie survival one. One of them is a medieval reenactor in his armor with his, you know, with his weapons and stuff like that. So we always find ways, and even in science fiction, you're guaranteed we'll find ways to put swords and spears and things in, no matter what, because we're slightly obsessed with, you know, with those weapons. But
Star Wars is a great example of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I did a Sherlock Holmes and the zombie problem, and that should allow me to throw in all of the late 19th century stuff. So there's just loads of the really cool swords that I really like straight into that. So that was quite good fun.
Every plot is how do we get the swords in?
Yeah, it can get like that, definitely.
So we've talked about swords. Let's look at the swords. So first off, what's your favourite? Have you got your favourite there?
You know, it's a really tough call, but I'll just start with one that's an obvious one, which is this 18-inch saber. So I've got about 4 or 5 different examples of this particular pattern. So this is the kind of, well, the only actual pattern of infantry sabre in the Napoleonic era for the British. They had some other stuff that was kind of, well, you know, non-regulation against the rules, and just officers made their own thing, or didn't make their own thing, bought their own thing.
So just tell us what we have here, what pattern it is, and just describe the sword for the listeners.
Yeah, this is an 1803 infantry officer's sword, or flank officer's sword. So this is basically the elite infantry sabre for grenadier officers, light infantry officers. The elite, basically elite infantry officers of the Napoleonic period, between 1803 and 1821. And they come in a few different forms in terms of the blade and the grips, but the guards are all exactly the same. They're all this, what we would call slut hilt style, which is, it came in the 1760s roughly, and by the Napoleonic period was you know, the norm for some infantry officers. And they're just very, very pretty. They have the this GR cipher, the Crown cipher, which is George Rex, King George on here. And then they have the lion's head pommel on them.
Ooh. Is that an ivory grip?
Yes. So normally they have shagreen, so shark skin or ray skin or something like that. But there are examples with ivory, and they're probably very high-ranking officers' swords. So this is probably mm-hmm. something like a colonel's sword or potentially higher going up towards a general or something like that. Or perhaps just a very wealthy officer, because you did get, you know, wealthy officers at low ranks, particularly when they were younger in age. And then this particular one has lots of its blue and gilt left. So when the Napoleonic era swords, the most officers' swords had blue and gilt running half to two thirds of the length of their blade. But most of them have worn off, unfortunately, because it's really susceptible to damage, sadly. And most of it's gone on most swords, whereas this one is almost entirely complete, which is quite nice.
So do we know what the decorations are on there? I can see like a collection of arms on that one and the flag.
You've got Britannia here.
Yeah. Oh, that's who that is.
Yeah. Most of them are quite generic. So you've got a crown, you've got a GR cipher. Push it down. Trying to look in the camera and at the sword at the same time. So there's the George Rex cipher there. So it's all kind of quite generic, basically, kind of crown and military symbols. Mm. The one thing this sword has, which is unusual, is actually just after the blue and gilt, which, see if I can capture it. It is just here. There is a family crest.
So that's starting to come, or that's come away mostly, but you can still make it out.
Yeah. So that's basically some kind
of... Would these weapons have been standard issue and then the owner have them embellished, or would they just go off and have something commissioned to that design?
Yeah, they'd have... Every officer had to just buy their own sword, and that didn't change until World War One. So an officer was told the type of sword they had to buy, but then they just went and got it wherever they fancied. And that means, particularly in the Napoleonic era, it means that the specification can just be wildly different. Like this particular sword, they specified a guard, but the blade, not at all. There's no pattern for the blade, so they can be any length, any curvature. They can be, you know, wildly different from one another. They can be blade lengths down to like 63 centimetres, so really quite short, up to kind of 84, 85 centimetre. So they can vary absolutely immensely. And as I said, on the curvature as well and the weight. You know, this thing is actually as heavy as a heavy cavalry sword. It's ridiculous. It's unusually very heavy.
So apart from being stunning, what's the main reason why this is your favourite?
It's a combination of the factors of how it's been made. Is that it's unusually heavy, unusually robust. The blade here is 4.5 centimetres wide. That's incredibly broad for this type of sword.
Very big.
And it's also on the spine, it's down there, it's 10 millimetres thick.
So, wow, that is chunky.
Yeah, it's very chunky. This one's called the Golden Chunk between a few friends. That's its name. Yeah. We do have chunky boys as well.
Do you know, like... Are you able to find out whether, I mean, this is quite grisly, but are you ever able to find out whether a weapon has seen action, or if it was ever just, if it was always just
Not clothing? You know, sometimes they'll have edge damage that, you know, means that they've been used, but they could have been, you know, a few kids bashing them in the 1950s, or sort of, you know, theatre use or just anything. You can look at the damage in a blade and you can tell if it's old because of the way that the blade has aged in the damaged parts, in the burred sections of the blade. If it's relatively clean and shiny, well, you know it's been done recently. But unfortunately, these are 200-year-old swords. So, you know, if it was done 100 years ago, it would have aged in that time and you wouldn't know. So, I mean, everybody wants to look at a sword with battle damage and think that it was done at an actual battle, but we'll never know. We'll absolutely never know.
No way of telling.
No.
And what was the very first sword you bought? You mentioned it.
Yeah, a droon.
Have you got that with you?
I haven't got that one here because, frankly, it's not a very exciting sword. So it's best I'll just tell you about it. It's from 1822, and it's a gendarme's sword, so French paramilitary force, basically. And it's similar to a British spadroon of the era. And it's just not the best, not the most interesting example, but it got me started. And particularly as I've got a bit of a passion for spadroons, it's kind of funny that that's the sort of sword that I ended up with as my first one.
Okay, so we are halfway through. There's five folks watching us at the moment. One of them is your lovely partner, Esther, I think. And I just want to sort of say to the folks at home who are watching and listening, if you want to ask Nick anything about swords, about HEMA, about books, anything at all, then just drop us a question. At the bottom of your screens, there's a speech bubble with a question mark in it. Just tap that, type in your question, and we will read it out. I'm just going to go through the chat because I saw people saying stuff earlier in case anyone's asked us anything in the meantime. Sometimes they ask questions in there. Did we survive the riot Sunday? Yes, because we're far away from them. And you're in Wales, so you're fine.
Yeah, we didn't hear any of it. So.
typical sword nerd. How dare you? Tech support was needed. With a good buddy, stumbling through stuff can be a lot of fun. That goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about how people start out when they're beginning HEMA. I mean, nowadays there's no real reason to stumble through anything because you've got the internet and you've got instructors like yourself and tons and hundreds of hours of stuff on YouTube that you can watch. There's the Wickton Hour, there's the HEMA Alliance to show you where your nearest club is.
Yeah, it's still funnier than it used to be, definitely. Programs as well. I mean, we just have sort of lessons on YouTube, but there are, for example, there's the broadsword program that the Catarant Society run, which is an online program for running through broadsword stuff. So there's massive access to the manuals, to interpretations, to lessons. We are a bit spoilt today compared to what we were, in the best of ways. So it is a hell of a lot better.
It's a lot easier to find people to fight.
Massively so.
Hi from Belarus. Right, so caught up with all the chat. Right, this is you have an awful lot of swords. You're always putting up pictures of your latest acquirements, acquisitions. I was going to ask you, do you ever sell, or can you not bring yourself to part with your babies?
It's super, super rare. I've sold a few things that aren't super of interest to me. You know, my main collection is British Napoleonic stuff, and especially infantry of that period. Of my Napoleonic collection, I've only ever sold two swords, and they're to the same person, and he's one of my students. And it's only because he's often here and we're drinking beers and talking about swords, and he's managed to convince me to sell them. So, he's the only person I've ever sold any Napoleonic swords to.
You're in no hurry to part with any of them, I can tell. And that you're selling it to someone that you're going to see regularly so you can make sure it's in good hands.
Exactly.
We've got a question here. From Foxhound 027, what are your thoughts on the British heavy cavalry sabre?
There we go. This one. So It's basically massively undervalued. It's generally got a bad reputation, and it's actually a really decent all-round sword. It's not a perfect sword, and certainly the way they came out of the factories was not ideal. The tip on them was awful. It was a very blunt hatchet tip, but for thrusting it was a disaster. But once they modified them, so mine is modified, so it has a modified spear point on it, which is which was done in the time period by orders. Yeah, once that was done, they're actually really quite a good sword. A lot of the time people handle reproductions and they think they're kind of clumsy and slow, and the reproductions are. But if you handle the original things like this, I mean, this is a whisker over 1 kilo, which, you know, in sword terms, is just not, it's not wild by any means. Now, I'm not saying it's as simple as a 1 kilo side sword, if you like, but it's far from slow. And, you know, people worship, for example, say, Highland broadswords, and there's so little difference between this and a Highland broadsword in terms of handling characteristics and even relative protection. So, yeah, they get a bad reputation. I'm not saying they're perfect, but they're actually quite a good all-rounder. And it's kind of funny that people rave on about the light cavalry sabers, whereas for the most part, I think this is actually a better sword, mainly because it has a bit more reach, balances closer to the hand, and more hand protection as well. So they're actually quite a good sword.
So cavalry saber implies horseback use.
Yeah, yeah.
Were they always, were they always used from horseback, or were they ever used on foot as well?
Yeah, they were used on foot. I mean, the intention is that they were just for horseback usage, but in reality, cavalry did dismount to go over rough terrain and stuff like that. And sometimes they just had to fight on foot because, you know, they had the horse shot out under them or bayoneted or whatever else, some nasty stuff. But, you know, for example, at Waterloo, there was one British cavalryman with one of these, a heavy cavalryman, who was on foot, and he ended up fighting two cuirassiers. So he's fighting two heavily armoured French heavy cavalrymen on foot with one of these, and he actually took both their heads off.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Cuirassiers are the guys with the big breastplate on, I'm taking it.
Yeah, so that's where the name comes from. Yeah, they're wearing a back and breastplate of steel and usually a helmet as well. So compared to when the British didn't have anything like that, compared to what the British had, it was very heavily armoured.
There's a famous picture, isn't there, of a cuirass with the bomb, like a cannonball going through the front. Was it through the back and out the front, or the other way around?
Yeah, and you know, those cannonballs, they hit people, well, that's what they're designed for. I mean, solid ball shots was still the most common thing fired in that period. So, you watch the movies and all the cannonballs are exploding. The solid ball was the most common thing that was in use at the time. So, I mean, that probably did happen a lot. It's just not many people were wearing cuirasses. So I'm sure there would have been plenty of uniform jackets that with huge holes through them.
That originally had a hatchet tip, you said. What would that have looked like?
That's a good point. I can show you.
Good point or a bad point?
This is actually a really, really rare sword. This is also a heavy cavalry of the same year, 1796 pattern heavy cavalry. But this is for the horse guard. So it's a very, very rare and unusual type. The blade is still the same, but the hilt is very different. But this still has its original hatchet tip.
Oh, I see.
And so
slightly wider.
Yeah, it's just very, very blunt, effectively. It's the other sword. Yeah. They've ground this section of the blade, they've ground smoother, and they've ground some of the back edge in as well. So it's got a much gentler curve into the tip. Whereas this, yeah, it's a very, very blunt tip. And this isn't the worst of them. Some of them can be even more kind of, you know, squared off and blunt and fractal.
So what was the idea behind that? Was that for strength? So it wouldn't snap or something?
Honestly, we don't really know. These heavy cavalry swords, they weren't really of British design. They just copied the Austrian swords. So these heavy cavalry swords, the British ones, they're just a copy of the old Austrian Palash from about the 1740s. And so I think basically what happened is that Gaspard Le Marchant, who designed the light cavalry saber, and he had a huge passion for the Austrian swords, and he designed the light cavalry saber. And then he wanted that sword to be used by everyone, and the heavy cavalry said no. And I think what he basically did is he found the closest Austrian sword to what they would like and just said, we'll have this instead. I mean, not this one. This one, the one I showed before. So yeah. I don't think necessarily intended for anything on it. It is near enough, 99% copy of the Austrian sword. So I don't think the design choices were really anything the British intended.
It's just a copy.
Yeah. Up until this point, the British were using basket hilt swords for the heavy cavalry. Hmm. So, I didn't think there was necessarily an intention behind that hatchet tip. It's not a very good tip for really, for any purposes. I mean, you could see it carries a bit of mass in the tip, but not much. And those hatchet tips...
He's answered here, Foxhound, the guy who asked the question. Cool, always loved the look of that sword, but I just found out that people hate it. And you just sort of explained why people hate it. And it's a bit unfair, really.
I mean, a large part of it is collectors are blamed for the reason that it's hated so much, is that collectors, through the late 19th and into the 20th century, they've picked it up and thought it's heavy compared to, you know, certain other, often infantry swords. And they're comparing it to the wrong things. I mean, if you compare that heavy cavalry sabre to a lot of heavy cavalry sabres that came before and after it, it's not unwieldy by any means. Is they're basically judging it by the wrong standard. Is, you know, it's comparing it to the wrong things. It is actually a good all-rounder, good sword.
Now, talking about swords that people hate, why do you think it's so fashionable? It probably isn't anymore. It's probably not cool anymore. Why do you think it became so cool and fashionable to hate the Spadroon in the HEMA movement?
Yeah. Again, historical sources, and more so than collectors, are largely to blame for this, is that usually what happens is collectors will put a book together, and they'll take a quote from the time, and then 100 other collectors, 1,000 other collectors will repeat it and say the same thing over and over. So the thing with the Spadroon that really gets it the bad press is Cavalry Mercer, who was a horse artilleryman in the Napoleonic period, and he fought at Waterloo and stuff like that. And he famously said that they are the perfect encumbrance, and he hated them and everything else. But you need to have a bit of perspective on that, is that he's a horse artilleryman, which meant he carried a big sabre. And somebody who carries a very substantial, large sabre is probably not at all going to like something that is nimble and lightweight. And so that one example from somebody who wasn't actually using the swords, really, gets repeated over and over by every single source you can possibly imagine. So you'll see it on the Royal Armoury site, you'll see it on sort of big collector's books like Robson's, that's kind of the Bible for British military swords. Mm. And you see it everywhere, and people keep spreading the same thing. And it's a bit weird because in HEMA, of course, we look at the sources all the time. And if you look at the sources all the way through the 18th century, they love the Spadroons. Every British source from even before that, the late 17th century with William Hope, they absolutely love them, think they're the best thing ever. So
you said earlier that Spadroons can be amazing, and they can be really, really quite shoddy as well.
Yeah.
They're quite missed by the sounds of it.
Exactly. The sword we're talking about is the one that fell over, actually. So this is this is a Spadroon from the 1780s or maybe early 1790s. And a little unusual in that it has a back strap, which is peculiar, actually. Some Spadroons have them, but it's not common. Normally they would just have, a pommel, like a small sword. But the problem is there's not much leeway for making something good out of it. Is that if it's very easy to end up with too little mass in the foible in the week, and also just something that's a bit too light and a bit too brittle. So you know there are some examples. I can flex them almost to the tip down to the hilt, and they're just so flexible, so floppy. And yeah, it's a good example. This is actually quite a good example. Just as stiff as a saber. And so the problem is there are some really bad examples. And this actually happened a lot in the Napoleonic period, is that officers could purchase their swords from wherever they wanted. And part of the problem was that they went to what were called tailors. They are tailors. They bought tailors' swords. A tailor's sword is a sword bought from a tailor. So an officer might go to buy his uniform and his saddle and everything else. And the sword would be available in the same shop. And think, well, I'll just buy everything at once. It's convenient. But those tailors sold swords for, well, whatever they could get, any kind of different quality, any different source. So you don't know what you're getting. So if you went and bought a sword from a reputable source, so this, for example, is this blade is by Runkel. So Runkel was it's a German import blade, and they were very high quality. You know you're getting something good. But if it has no name on it whatsoever, and you don't know where you bought it from, you could be getting anything. And some of them were absolutely atrocious. Whereas I think if you take, say, a like cavalry saber, the tolerances for making a good blade are actually far less, because ultimately it's just a big chopper.
And you're always buying new swords. I follow your feed. There's always pictures of pretty things that you've bought. Is there anything that you're looking for in particular at the moment? Now might be the time to let people know.
Yeah, there are two swords on my wish list right now.
We've got some sword dealers watching, as it happens.
Oh, good. One I've been chasing for ages, which the Highland officers in the Napoleonic period had a basket hilt still. Only the Highlanders, not the Lowland officers. The Highland officers had a basket hilt that looked like your traditional 18th century Scottish Highland basket hilt. But it was brass, the guard, rather than steel that you would more commonly see. So it was the pattern 1798, and they're quite rare. And they were used by the Highland officers, the Highland sergeants, the fifers and the drummers as well. So there should be enough of them around, but they are hard to find and always expensive. So I'm after that. And also a heavy cavalry officer's sword. So I showed a heavy cavalry sword earlier on, but an officer's example of that would be on my list as well. Those are the two things.
Okay, so that's your shopping list. We'll send out some feelers. We'll see what we can do. Okay, so to finish up then, what advice do you have for someone who wants to start collecting antique swords? What mistakes should they avoid?
So there are two problems there. One is there are unscrupulous dealers around, and it's hard to find information on which ones they are. And two is just, there are now a lot of reproductions that are sold as antiques, and it's got a lot worse in the last sort of few years. And there are aged replicas and things like that. And they even come up at auction. Even with major auction houses, people go and buy from major auction houses and expect them to be genuine. And mostly they are, but every couple of weeks, an aged replica gets sold as an antique for the price that you would pay for an antique. The best thing you can do is just keep researching. I mean, as I said, that Robson book, Robson's book on British military swords is kind of a Bible, essentially, for what we do. And the other thing is just go on to, groups and forums and stuff like that. I mean, on Facebook, we've got the International Antique Collectors group, which is pretty good. And the main thing is just keep researching and keep reading. And that's the best you can possibly do.
So, yeah, do your homework. There's a lot of sword community folks on Instagram, like yourself. There's Matthew, there's Matt Easton, and there's, my mind's gone blank. There's Thierry. Most people, they are not on their websites, they've often got advice and stuff, and lots of these folks are very approachable as well to help if you're stuck about something. It's a very small community, I guess, so everybody seems to know everybody else, and there's a lot of overlap with the HEMA community as well. So I mean, if anyone's sort of looking to delve into this, there's a lot of support out there, but tread carefully, get as much support and advice as you can, do your homework, same as with HEMA, really. But thanks so much for joining me, Nick. It was really fascinating to look at some of your enormous collection and hear the stories behind the weapons. And to hear, for me, it was really interesting to sort of hear the origin story of how you got into HEMA and how you ended up following this path. Thank you very much.
I'll give you one last closing one, though.
Oh, yes.
So this one is on my favourite sword list, is also high up there, and that's because it's a Welsh officer's sword.
Uh-huh.
So it's a completely unique pattern to the Welsh Fusiliers of this period, and it's based on their experience in Egypt. It's it kind of very heavily borrows from the Mamluk sword out there, basically the Kilich style swords. And so it borrows the shape of the langets here, the shape of the lion's head. And you can see it does say actually Royal Welsh Fusiliers on there. And then the blade itself also copies the Kilich style. It's actually been worn down because it's been so heavily sharpened. So it did actually have what we call a yelmen on the back, so a pronounced back edge, which is sharpened as well, which is very unusual. It's very unusual.
It's double-edged.
Yeah, for the up to here, so about 12 inches, 10 inches, something like that. And yeah, that's very unusual for British swords of this period, and it's completely unfullered. So it's kind of, you know, certain British, and in this case Welsh, officers took on a flavour from their experiences in Egypt, and that's very much what this is. So it's a regimental pattern, and this one took me a decade to find because they're very rare.
That's very cool. It's not awfully long, is it, either?
No, the blade is 77 centimetres, which, I mean, a lot of Napoleonic sabres, especially the infantry types, are shorter than people think. You know, around about 75 to 80 centimetres is very, very typical. So, yeah, they are a lot shorter. People think of sabres today in the Hemiscene. Most people are using kind of bowl hilt sabres, and the blade lengths are around 85, 86 centimetres. But in the Napoleonic period, the only things that the British had that were reaching that length were heavy cavalry swords. So, yeah, the black fences that we use, because we use a lot of black fences sabres, they were based on this one, which is another 1803, like I showed earlier on. So this was the foundation for the training swords that we now use.
So those are custom ones that you had made for you by Black Fencer?
Well, yeah, they were custom initially, but they're now production models. So they're 1803, they're 1796 infantry models. They're all based on my collection and others that I've handled and stuff like that. So, this was the foundation for the 1803 that they had. And they hit the specification within about 10 grams. So, it's very, very accurate.
Nice. That's good to know for people who want to get into those weapons, that there are affordable trainers out there which are good simulators of the real thing based on your advice. So that leaves me to say thank you so much for joining me, Nick. We've been just almost an hour. It was lovely to talk to you. And yeah, are you coming to Fight Camp?
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent. I'll see you there.
And about 12 to 15 of our club will go in.
Awesome. I'll see all of the folks from AHF when I'm there. Hopefully it doesn't rain.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Take care.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
Bye.
We
hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.